Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about racism. Then, now, what's the difference and how should it be handled? How should it be addressed? My guests are Dr. Greg Carr, Chair of the Afro-American Studies Department here at Howard University, and Patrice Sultan. She is a civil rights attorney as well as a criminal justice advocate. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before the break, we were talking to Hassan. Patrice, what were your thoughts about the story that he shared? Because I would imagine that you see a lot of those similar kinds of things.
I do. I see a lot of examples of excessive use of force. I see a lot of examples of racial profiling. I see a lot of examples of police officers making false reports. And I think that it's an interesting insight that discrimination isn't just about hate crime and harassment. It's also the devaluing, as Hassan said, of Black lives, and sort of the suggestion that ruining someone's day with that kind of a traumatic event doesn't seem to matter if a person is not legally empowered to do anything about it. And we spend a lot of time in our communities talking about know your rights under the law and know what the police are allowed to do and what the police aren't allowed to do. But it really doesn't matter if you don't know your remedies at law and you don't understand what is it that you're going to be able to do about it.
Explain that. What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, if somebody has been even physically abused by a police officer, if you're not in a position to be able to hire experts in policing and what's appropriate force, experts in medicine to talk about how you sustained your injuries, things that cost tens of thousands of dollars, it's unlikely that you're going to find someone that's able to take your case in a way that you'll be able to recover damages that are more than what it costs to litigate something like that. And so unless you really organize and have power in numbers to say this is what we're going to do about making sure that we're exposing the officers who are behaving in this way, that pattern of behavior is going to continue. It's very difficult to address an issue that's systemic through the legal system, to pull people together as a class, and you're at a huge disadvantage in the context of interacting with police officers, because at issue is the criminality that they're accusing the people of in the first place. So how great a plaintiff are you going to be if you're also being charged with a crime? Or if you already have a prior criminal conviction that can be used to impeach you if you testify in your own trial.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Mike calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Mike. What's on your mind?
Just wanted to bring some light to the American University issue recently, that actually there was a challenge with nooses and bananas maybe less than a year ago. I think the Greek organizations, I look on social media recently and I see all the people in the room of this issue with the AKAs, but I think the Greek organizations have a lot of power, a lot of influence, and they're missing their opportunity to speak out when we have racial issues. And I just think we should bring some light to that. Now that it's the AKAs, there's a room full of Greeks in the room, but when they're not people of Greek or fraternities and sororities, they don't show up when we see the videos of police brutality and things as such. I think we're missing opportunities.
Mike, thank you for that comment. Your thoughts about that? I think he does make an interesting point, because I think it really kind of goes back, Dr. Carr, to something you said earlier. You have pre-segregation, and we're all in this together. Post-segregation and post segregation, if I may, things are a little are not as connected.
Well, once the hedge of legal segregation was removed, the class function in the Black community became a lot more stark and apparent. In no society, in no capitalist society, does the elite class or the upper class throw in and make common cause with the lower class. Legal segregation held us together. And that's one reason I really have a lot of respect for Attorney Sultan and the work that she's doing in helping to train a new generation of young attorneys and lawyers to try to fight, because that was a given when Charlie Houston was at Howard Law. and, you know, and Pauli Murray was over there as a student, and Thurgood Marshall, because the whole idea was to dismantle Jim Crow. But then when you, the black middle class helped negotiate on behalf of the group. But once legal segregation was over, you know, that class followed the same function as most elites. They began to withdraw into themselves. And so even the language we use, giving back, let's give back. Well, that presumes that the large group of people that you came from are somehow less than you are. So I wouldn't expect the black Greek letter organizations to do any much more than ape the white Greek letter organizations at this point. In fact, it would be counterintuitive. And so what we have to do is fight back against that. But we'll be fighting back against something that is very pretty common in a capitalist society, which is to leave the group.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about racism then, racism now. What's the difference and how the issue should be addressed today? Let me go to Renee. Renee calling from D.C. Renee, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello. Hi. Good evening, everyone.
How are you?
Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, years ago I worked at a private affluent school. And at that time, there were very few black teachers in the after-school program. And I did experience a comment that was made to me. And we were all sitting around in a teacher's lounge, and we were planning for the menus of snacks for the kids. And one of the white teachers had said to me, we were talking about fruit, because fruit is a very, in the most affluent schools and schools that have a majority of a lot of white kids, that the eating habits are totally different in terms of the healthy snacks that they have. And they said to me, a woman said to me, well, you know, Renee, what about watermelon? Now, you know, my reaction to that was, I did not react in a hostile way, although it was a very racist comment to say and totally unnecessary and unprofessional. But, you know, it made me start thinking about how racism is different. You know, we have, I think a lot of it is based on these preconceived notions that really white America has about us as people. And so, you know, when I start thinking about how it's infiltrated in everything that we do, one of the things that I do, I mean, I think that we ought to be social advocates for injustices and still continue the fight that we have in different areas of our lives. But one of the things that I do, you know, when new people come into the neighborhood, mm-hmm. and with this gentrification going on, it's really an opportunity for white America to really get to know who we are. One of the things that I do personally, you know, call it corny, but I bake cakes and take it to the neighbors and say, welcome to the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I think that I want to prove that I'm worthy to be your neighbor. It has nothing to do with that. I want you to see me as a person, because I think that
okay.
we have to have the dialogue, because it starts as seeing me as part of you.
Okay.
We have to have kinship. So we have to have that difficult discussion, and we have to build a rapport.
Well, Renee, I appreciate what you're saying. I've got some other calls, but you make a great point. And I do want to ask, you know, Patrice, about that very point. When you're dealing with issues, as I mentioned before, not institutions of racism, but I'm talking about individuals or social settings where you may have blatant racism, or ignorance based on race, is a good understanding of your own race and a teachable moment the best way to deal with those kinds of situations?
I don't know if I'm an expert on how to interact with other people.
With other races. How do you interact with the racists out there?
I will say that I find it, personally, I find it very difficult to separate the institution from the individual interactions. I think working in the criminal defense field as long as I have, I find it very difficult to accept the premise of the argument that we should expect people to treat us like anything other than animals when we tolerate a system of government treating us like animals. And I just find it so brutal the way that the government interacts with the community. And I think that our neighbors and others see that. And I think that their impressions of what's acceptable and their impressions of who we are come just as much from the way that they see institutions treat us as it does from the way that we treat them on a one-on-one basis. And I think it's very easy when you have an individual interaction that's positive, that's very different than the institutional impression you have, that it's easy for our white neighbors to then just sort of rationalize that this person isn't as black or they're not the same, sort of like, you know, the Oprah comment that she took so much offense to of, you know, you're not really black. You're in this other category. You're okay. As opposed to them then seeing the entire group as a reflection of your actions. They're going to see us the way that we're treated.
So what you're suggesting is, you know, at the point where you are seen as, you know, educated, cultured, refined, the whole bit. At that point, racism removes you from the collective of how they see black people, or dare I say, people of color in general, and see you as an exception.
Temporarily, until there's something at stake, because I'm sure that Renee, some of your neighbors would enjoy that cake. And if the police roll up in front of your house, their first question would not be why are the police harassing you, but what did you do? Mm-hmm. We can never escape our blackness. And, you know, it's very interesting as we're thinking, I'm listening to you talking, Teresa, I'm thinking you see it every day. I mean, you look in that so-called criminal justice system, you see the reality. And the same microaggressions that would have somebody bring up watermelon in a teacher's, lounge, or that's the same attitude that a police person brings to the job and can lead literally to the death of a black person. So, no, I mean, you can never escape your race. And the power of white supremacy lies in its invisibility and in the complicity of people who will not move, as you say, against institutions. So they just stand back like, oh, my God, what happened, Renee? I'm so sorry. What did you do? I didn't do anything. No, you must have done something. I mean, I enjoyed the cake, but and that's what I would expect from you. Why y'all bake cakes, right? And sing and dance. And, you know, you're my favorite Negro. And then if the police come up, the assumption is that law, the function of law in a society is to maintain order. Mm-hmm. And those Negroes have to be policed. So we never really truly leave the group. I mean, Oprah found that out in that store in Paris. Right?
Mm-hmm. As did that the doctor from Texas on the airplane who was head of her division, and the flight attendant discounted, you know, her proclamation that, yes, I am not only a doctor, I'm a physician, and, you know, and I can take care of this. And she said, no, sweetie, we need a doctor. And so, again, I think those kinds of images, that kind of racial ignorance can be, you know, detrimental, not only to the black folks, but also to the person who was sick on the plane.
Well, let me say this right quick here. I know that's one of the reasons we work where we work. Life too short, brother. And so when people listen to this show every night, they can get some information that's going to help our common humanity. It's not restricted by color. But at the same time, you have to explain your humanity at work every day. Mm-hmm. The reason I work at Howard is because I made a decision. I'm not going to spend my life trying to prove my humanity. Life is too short. And you know, I treat everybody with common respect. I want all of us to move together as we progress as human beings. But at the end of the day, my life is too short to be explaining my humanity. There's some much more interesting things I want to do in life, and one of them is not explaining my existence to white people.
Mason, calling from D.C. What's on your mind, Mason?
Yes, good evening to everyone. I have a question and a comment.
Sure.
I came in before the 7:30 p.m. Daily Drum came on, and you asked your guest attorney a question, and I listened carefully. And she did not answer the question, and you correct me if I was wrong. And I'm going to throw this little note in there. I had experienced, I'm from originally from Alexandria, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and I had experienced disability and racial discrimination, and I reached out to Howard University, their law school, and I've been living over here for almost, what, about 10 years, and I was quite shocked that no one called me back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't. Unfortunately, Mason, I can't speak for the law school. You know, I can only speak for this program. And, you know, I would. But let me suggest. And that is why we have an attorney here. Real quick, Patrice, if she feels that she has been discriminated against racially or as a result of a disability, who should she call?
Well, if you're looking for an attorney to provide free legal services or services on a contingency basis, you would want to look to an organization like the Washington Lawyers Committee, which does some disability discrimination law. There are several prominent civil rights firms in D.C. that take these cases sort of on a contingency basis, and they'll screen your case and talk to you about it. But the law school itself, I don't know of having a disability rights clinic per se, but some of the schools might have something like that.
Mm. Well, Mason, thank you so much for your phone call, and good luck to you. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Racism then, racism now, what's the difference? How should it be addressed? We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue the conversation. We're talking about racism then, racism now. What's the difference in how it should be addressed? 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. George calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, George. What's on your mind? George, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening.
Good evening. Go right ahead.
I think the key to dealing with racism for us is to continue to love ourselves.
What do you mean by that, George?
I mean, if you feel good about yourself and you're positive, people can sense a glow about you. You know.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, George, thank you very, very much. I appreciate you chiming in on that. Let's go to Diane.
Something Patrice, you said earlier, you know, people treat you the way you allow them to treat you.
Okay.
So this question of self-respect is connected to this notion of self-concept. I mean, you know, would the police behave the way they behave if our community simply said, we're not going to tolerate this anymore? Not just in terms of petitions to city council or giving. No, but you're not coming in this neighborhood. First of all, get off this corner. I'm calling. If you park your car on here and you're just going to surveil my community, I'm calling y'all supervisor. You're not coming. Go sit in the white neighborhood. In other words, some of this does come back to how much we will tolerate.
Well, that goes back to the question I was asking earlier. So how should these things be addressed when, you know, and I'm talking not about institutions, but individual incidents, you know, because, you know, you have the, you know, the Patrice Sultans of the world that are, you know, you're going to the port to the courthouse with pitchforks and torches every day, you know, representing your clients. But as in the case of Hassan, who called earlier, you know, how should you be able to address, if not the police, but individuals? You know, and that's, and that goes back to what I was saying. Does an education about who you are and knowing where you come from, is that the best defense? Or provided that you have a teachable moment when a racist says something that is ignorant? You know, you have the opportunity to beat them in the head or to disarm them with your intellect.
You know, it's interesting. Whiteness is weaponized identity. White people are not going to let you treat them a certain way. I mean, we remember the video year before last, when the police were harassing the brother who was in the white neighborhood here in D.C. and the white woman went out there and said, get away from him. He's working. That comes from the sense that I am a human being. The restoration of black humanity has to be our number one project. So in that respect, I agree with George. He didn't say it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But everything comes from that. I mean, there's a certain way you have to be treated. I mean, if you're coming into a space already trying to prove that you're somehow worthy of being a human being, you've already been defeated. There's really nothing that you can do after that that's going to do anything except worsen your condition. You can't, I mean, you know, wait, I was born, you were born. Okay, now that we've cleared that we're human, let's move forward. Not I was born, you was born, and I'm going to prove to you that I was worthy to be born. Oh, no, well, then you've already, it's over.
Hmm. Okay. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Diane, calling from D.C. Diane, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good evening.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment. I wanted to say that racism is still alive, well and kicking throughout the United States, corporate America, and in the federal government. The only difference is that they no longer wear the white hoods. And the sad part about it is that they place overseers over the black employees in the federal government. Majority of the time, they are black, dark-skinned males, and they take a few extra dollars and mistreat the employees within the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sad part about it, that they are very disrespectful towards the coworkers.
So how do you, so let me ask you this, Diane, because by the use of the term overseer, that suggests that this is nothing new.
Oh, of course not.
And with that said, so what is, and this is not just a question to you, but it's a question to my panel, how do you address that in 2017 if you indeed have the quote-unquote overseer, whether it's federal government or private industry or what have you, if you know these things exist and you have to exist in that space, how do you address it?
Well, of course, we know it's the legal way to address it, but I can only speak personally. I deal with a lot of prayer, and I tend to follow through and do what I need to do in terms of the legal system, in terms of filing complaints against the organizations, which everyone has a right to do so. But I do not stoop to their level. I don't come down to their level. I rise above. I have to be exceptionally, my work has to be exceptionally better, three or four times better. Even with that said, there's always the individuals that I said are placed as the overseers that try to diminish your abilities and capabilities and try to be very disrespectful and degrade and demoralize you.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to rise above. You have to stay in constant, fervent prayer.
Okay.
And just seek God to help you through it, because it's a rough situation. It's a hard situation, but you can overcome it.
Okay. Diane, thank you so much.
I was going to say, you know, it's interesting. The American Project, which is really a fundamental hoax, I think, in terms of even the American experiment. There was a moment 50 years ago, we're talking about, you know, racism then and now. The civil rights movement gave this country an opportunity to move past some of its most difficult structural problems. So when you see the for example, the Civil Rights Act, 1960, Voting Rights 65, Civil Rights Act is 67, I guess, 60. When you see the 68. Title VII, for example, employment discrimination, all these things could have had teeth in them because they went back to the Reconstruction Amendments, particularly the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, right? But what happens in a society when you will not weaponize the law to really stand for justice? What happens then when you internalize self-hatred? This is what we're talking about in this case now. Renee is talking about, I think, where there'd be Clarence Thomas, ironically, at the EEOC terrorizing black women like Anita Hill and others. Or you're right, Renee. Diane. You're right, Diane, about a lot of this. I guess I'm looking at Patrice and I'm asking myself, could you bring a Title VII case that was intra-racial, that dealt with something that we don't like to talk about a lot, this internalized white supremacy, like colorism? Mm-hmm. So when you have somebody terrorizing black folks based on skin color who is themselves black, Title VII doesn't have a mechanism for dealing with intra-racial struggle, because in part, Title VII has been absorbed, just like Title IX and the stuff around gender, has been absorbed for other purposes than the ones that it was passed to deal with, which is structural inequality. So now we don't even, the law, you know, the law in some ways, I don't know, what do you think about that? Has the law somehow taken a step back in terms of the potential of what the law could have done, particularly this federal legislation 50 years ago, and where we are today?
Patrice.
Yeah, there are some.
Yes, I do feel that way.
Diane, I was talking to Patrice, but go right ahead, Patrice.
Mm-hmm. There are some barriers to redressing intraracial discrimination, and especially when we look at also how the Supreme Court interprets constitutional law, so the Equal Protection Clause and the Voting Rights Act, they're looking at the relationship between historical discrimination and whether certain aspects of a law are still necessary in light of the way that people interact. There hasn't been as much of a discussion about how it should be evolving to address new forms of discrimination as the world changes. But it does make it difficult. And I think the overseer concept is an interesting one. It's something that you certainly see at play in other institutions and prosecutor's offices and probation offices. On
prisons.
When I have black juries, it's very interesting to see the role that the black jurors play when they have a federal job or a particular standing in the community that they want to distance themselves from people who have been arrested. It's really interesting how that dynamic plays out. So I appreciate that comment. Mm.
Diane, thank you so much.
Sonia Sotomayor said that when she came to Howard Law, just after she gotten sworn in, she said when she was prosecuting in New York, she used to like to try to get some people, non-white people of color, because white people have color too, but non-white people of color in the jury box if she was trying to put a black defendant away, particularly Africans from the Caribbean. This class function comes in. They're like, no, we're going to distance ourselves from. And if you look at the so-called war on crime in the 1970s and 80s, scholars like Khalil Muhammad and others have documented how a lot of this stuff got pushed. Ta-Nehisi Coates writes about this in The Atlantic. When you talk about mass incarceration by middle class blacks who call themselves trying to deal with the criminal element in our community, that is internalized self-hatred. That's fascinating to hear you say that, though, Patrice, and walk us through how you see that manifest in the jury box and the prosecutors thing. Moment to moment in real time. It's got to be heartbreaking to see that.
Richard, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Richard. What's on your mind?
How you doing? A whole lot after hearing everything I've heard. You know, it's kind of hard to sum this up in so many words, because from what I see and from my growing, racism is a natural attribute first and foremost, you know, maybe to certain levels. But it's lifestyles at the same time. So in me saying that, if you're raised with people of different race, you normally fit in a little bit better. But if you're completely separate, and you know how America works, America is the most racist country in the world. And that's due to marketing of the government. The more intangibles they throw in to keep you less focused on what they're doing,
okay.
That's what they do. And that's what they will always do.
Richard, I got to let you go because I'm out of time. Boy, we talked all the way to the end on that one. We could do another show on this another hour, but we are out of time, and I want to thank my guests, Dr. Greg Carr and Patrice Sultan, for chiming in again on race then and now and how we address it. And thank you both so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the invitation here.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Monday, May 15th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can follow me on Twitter at HFisherWHUR or Daily Drum.